Warning, this podcast has stories of real-life events and true crime that happens every day. These stories may contain adult language and graphic or disturbing details not suitable for everyone. Listener discretion is advised. In our society, most people are content to go through their daily lives safely and peacefully. But our society is not always safe or peaceful. For that reason, some men and women answer a higher calling to defend and protect their fellow man. You probably know someone who is one of these people, or maybe you are one of these people. The ones who see and do the things most people would never want to. These things are sometimes heroic and beautiful, but often they are horrific and terrifying. It's these things they don't share about with other people. It's these things they carry with them, so you don't have to. But when they get together, they talk to each other about them. And they call these stories war stories. Welcome to another episode of War Stories. I'm Tom.
And I'm John.
And we are back with Mark and Ken.
Round two.
And this is an episode where we're going to be talking to Ken and get his story. And Mark has graciously agreed to be with us as the color man, as I like to say it, because, you know, you guys share a perspective that despite, you know, Mark's being in the Navy and Ken's being in the Army, you both went to the same place. And in a lot of cases, I'm guessing Mark as a corpsman and Ken as a helicopter pilot, you guys were running into, you know, cross-pollinating, cross-mogenating, as it were. Mark, again, you're here. Thank you. Mark was a Navy corpsman in Vietnam, and you said you were actually in country. You joined the Navy from 66 to 70, but you were in country starting in 68. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. And now Ken, U.S. Army, helicopter pilot. Why don't you tell us a little bit about, your time in the service and how you ended up there, and we'll start there.
Oh, okay. Well, I was drafted, so I thought I was doing fine in college, but I guess my grades weren't that good. But anyway, I was drafted.
Wait, how does that work?
I was mostly playing football and chasing cheerleaders, so wasn't like, paying much attention to my classes. That's how it works. Yeah,
get them out of here.
So the draft board goes to the college and says, which one of these kids isn't taking it seriously? And they pointed at Ken, and off you went.
That's right. I showed up at Fort Ord, California. I was 18 years old, and I had no idea what I was doing.
What year was this?
I took I'm sorry, what?
What year?
Oh, that was in 66.
Got
1966.
It. Oh. Okay, so there you go.
So you take a bunch of tests when you're first in, and after the test, some corporal comes up to me and says, hey, you want to go to OCS? And I go, what is that? And they said, you see those guys over there with the black stripes on their pants? Yeah. Well, those are officers, and they don't do a darn thing. They're a bunch of lazy SOBs. And I said, that's what I want to do.
So, I thought you just liked the black stripes on the pants.
Well, I found those quite attractive, but I went to OCS, and then about halfway through, they kept telling us about the casualty rate for second lieutenants in infantry. I was at Fort Benning, Georgia, and I thought, well, shoot, I got to weasel out of this somehow. I really don't want to get shot on, you know, and have Doc have to work on me. So I volunteered to go to flight school, and went to flight school and graduated from flight school in March of 69, and was in Vietnam just a few days later. Normally you had a leave before you went to Vietnam, but they were so short of pilots. I went straight from graduation at flight school to Vietnam. I was there on March 3rd. And the day before I got there, the whole company cadre had been killed in a rocket attack. Doc mentioned rockets. The name of our base was Dong Tam, but all of us called it Rocket City because we were getting rockets in there all the time. and a 122 came through the roof of our headquarters and killed the company commander and about half of the officers in the headquarters. So I got there right in the middle of a mortar attack, and I jumped off the helicopter, and the mortar rounds were coming down the flight line, and I jumped underneath the runway there, and there was a sort of a culvert, so I jumped in there, and there was like 20 guys already there, and I was a first lieutenant at the time. And one of the guys said, "Lieutenant, stand in the mouth of the culvert here so you can soak up any shrapnel that happens to come in here." So I'm sitting there, and I just still have this part. Part of the mortar round went off right over us, rang our ears, and the base where the primer shell is on the mortar round, when they drop it down the tube, it sets off the mortar charge. It came in, bounced off the culvert, hit me in the leg, didn't do any damage, just put a bruise on my leg. And I picked that up. I still have that piece. That was my first few minutes there. I went on into the operations.
Talk about a lucky charm. Jeez.
Wow.
Yeah, I was. Yeah, it was. It was. And I had that kind of luck the whole time I was over there. I went into operations, and there's still blood on the floor. And it was really gross. And they said, "Okay, Lieutenant Carlton, you're going to be in the guns." And I didn't even really know what that was. I had 205 hours of flight training, and they assigned me to the gun platoon. And our gun platoon had 8 helicopters, Charlie models, which are just a little bit smaller than the regular Huey, the H model. We had 2 platoons of H models, or slicks, as we called them, that carried their troops, and 1 platoon of gunships. And the 9th Division was there still in the Delta. This is down in Delta, the other end from where Doc was talking about earlier, the other end of the country. And we had the Brownwater Navy guys that we worked with every day. They were the guys that had the LSTs and the fast boats and the swift boats. We landed on the LSTs all the time for refueling and
that's a hell of a landing.
Rearming. I've got a story about that. Don't let me forget to tell you, because it can get really hairy on the ass end of one of those LSTs.
And I have a question real quick. When you say Delta, I'm assuming it's the Mekong, because that's like saying the valley. Well, you're talking about the San Fernando Valley. If you're in Vietnam and you say the Delta, it's the Mekong Delta, right? There's only one.
Mekong Delta, 4 Corps. Doc was up in 2 and I Corps, I believe, from what he said. And the further north you got, the hairier that whole damn thing got. I mean, in my flight school class, almost all of the guys that were killed were killed up north. We didn't have very many killed down there because where I was at in the Delta, because they had mostly light 51 calibers, where it's about the biggest they had down there. We'd get up towards Cambodia and they'd start shooting at us with the 37s, a radar control. But generally speaking, the jarheads up north and the army, the CAV guys and 101st puking buzzards. Do we know anybody that was a puking buzzard? The 101st were getting their asses shot off up in north compared to what was happening to us. So I'll be the first to say that. And when I went in, initially, I was assigned to the gun platoon, and that's what I did most of the time I was over there. And we were going out every morning at O Dark 30 and doing combat assaults using supporting the 9th Division. We weren't actually assigned to them. I was with the 1st Aviation Brigade, and the name of our company was the 191st Assault Helicopter Company. And we were we had one battalion that we basically supported. It was the commander was a real ass kicker. His name was Hackworth, David Hackworth.
And, Hackworth is a good name for an ass kicking commander.
Hey, let me tell you why. Once Hackworth took over and we were supporting them, it was a whole different ball game. I wasn't there before, but we were having guys shot right and left. But once Hackworth took over and we used Hackworth's rules of engagement, which was you kill everybody and I'll tell you when to stop killing them. And once we started doing that, things got a little bit better. However, I was the platoon commander of this platoon as a first lieutenant. And I had warrant officers working for me that had been over there a year already that really knew how to fly the helicopter. And I was just a total rookie when it came to flying. And I was fortunate that I listened to my warrant officers and was able to survive that thing. But soon enough, I became an aircraft commander, and we got in some shootouts where Hackworth was up in the CMC command and control, and he was keeping a close eye on what was happening on the ground, and we realized the 9th Division guys were being overrun, and so they were out of M60 ammo. So we hovered down right above them and kicked out a bunch of linked M60 ammo for them so they get their machine guns going again, because that, quite honestly, Doc alluded to that. If they could have given him an M60, he would have used it. That was probably one of the better weapons you could have over there because of the amount of firepower and reliability that it had. And the guys down on the ground, the lieutenant, who ended up being a 3-star general, presented me with my DFC here just about 5 months ago. They never had given it to me. And I happened to mention to him, he was a snivelly second lieutenant when all this stuff was going on. And he was even bitching at us because we was dropping hot links and brass down his neck because we're shooting the miniguns right over the top of him. And fast forward to Tampa, Florida in January, he pinned my DFC on and he retired as a 3-star general. Anyway, side story.
So how the DFC, the Distinguished Flying Cross, it took them from the
51 years.
Okay. Wow. I was going to ask what the math was because wow. I didn't know what year you earned it in, but you got it in 2020.
Well, what happened? The orders were actually cut on that thing after I left Vietnam. So I can't blame it totally on the Army. I went to Alaska and then at that time I was just glad to have survived it. You know, I was happy to have survived it. So it wasn't on my radar screen. But later on, I got to think, yeah, I'd really like to have that. And I happened to mention it to somebody that knew General Hughes. And he said, well, shoot, we're having a reunion in Tampa. Why don't we just pin it on your – and so I did. I went there. I had my dress blues on, which were a bigger size than what I had when I was flying. and had a great time, had my family there, and it was a great time. But anyway, back to the 9th Division. We flew over that same platoon about a week later, and there was about 35 dead Viet Cong or NVA laying in a perfectly side by side. And I called up Hughes and I said, hey, what's that shit on the ground? You're going to all the trouble of laying these guys next to each other? And he says, no, that's how we shot them. That was an ambush. They were on a trail and they just got wiped out immediately and fell shoulder to shoulder. And there was about 30 to 35 of them, BRT, dead right there.
That's pretty efficient.
So it was something else. The other thing we had down there, we had the Yumen Forest, which had we didn't know it at the time, had a whole division of NVA in there, and they were resupplied coming down through Cambodia into the South China Sea and then into that forest area, and it was a free fire zone, and every time we go down there, it was an ass kicker. Oh, to give you an idea, we would usually not go in there until the B-52 strikes had went in ahead of us. That's how bad it was. Wow. It was like our own little DMZ was a human forest, because you knew you were going to get in a big shootout every time you went in there. And the 9th Division actually went home in September of 69. That was one of the first units to go home. A few Marines... Doc, didn't you say one of your units had got deactivated and went back about the same time?
Yeah, I believe it was September 69, they removed
it. It was all part of a big plan called the Vietnamization. I believe Nixon might have been the president then, I don't remember. Oh, and while we're at it, they landed on the moon while I was there. And guess what? I didn't give a rat's ass about that. We were out in a big shootout in the Yumen Forest, and somebody said, hey, AFRN, Channel 5. Well, we had a FM AM radio in the helicopter. I go, what? And they go, we just landed on the moon. I said, well, we're about to get our asses waxed here, so let's pay attention to what we're doing. So it wasn't until later that I realized, oh, that was really cool. But at the time, it wasn't on my radar screen. But anyway, the 9th Division had left. We put in a company of Arvins. Now, the Arvins, that stands for Army of the Republic of Vietnam, I think, something like
it's
that.
It's the South Vietnamese were, Army, right?
Yeah, they were about as effective as a Cub Scouts. I wouldn't even say Boy Scouts.
Yeah, what is
they
it
were
with
pathetic.
The countries?
We called them chicken chokers. not chicken choker, chicken catchers. Chicken chokers is something else. Chicken catchers, the first thing they do when they got inserted would be to chase down all the local chickens that the Vietnamese had, and then they would have them for lunch because their officers were busy stealing all of the money they were supposed to feed their troops with. Anyway, we landed a whole company of these guys, and they immediately got wiped out. And it was really the problem was I didn't mind them getting wiped out, but they had an American first lieutenant that was an advisor, him and a sergeant, and both of them were wounded. And let's just go back to medevac. Oftentimes in the Delta, at least where I was at, the medevacs were back at Can Tho, Soc Trang, and Dong Tam. And they had field hospitals there. Everything was cool. But where the shooting was going on, immediately, if somebody was bleeding out, we were the closest helicopters. So we went in there and picked up the lieutenant that was the advisor, the American advisor, and his sergeant, and took him to Dong Tam. That same area, a couple of weeks later, I was shooting up a bunch of NVA running down a trail. They had the pith helmets on, backpacks, uniforms, the whole Marianne. And I was lining up on them with a rocket, and the last guy turned around and put his elbow up and shot at me with a rifle and put the round right through my helmet. Well, the windshield, the rocket sight, my helmet out through the number two hydraulic system of the Charlie model.
Holy
and,
shit.
Yeah. So it gets better.
Wait, were you carrying your lucky mortar piece?
Yeah. You want to see that helmet? I'll be glad to show it to you anytime.
Actually, if you could send us a picture, we'd like to post a picture of it.
So sir, they let me bring it home because nobody wanted to wear it. But anyway,
hold on one second, Ken.
Ken, hold on one second. I just had a question real quick before I forget regarding the medevacs and then obviously your guys' helicopters. So I understand that you said that you guys were the closest helicopters, and sometimes you guys, obviously your role has now changed. How was that more often than not?
Yes, and the reason is that we were doing combat assault. So once we inserted the troops, the CMC was still above us, the command and control helicopter, and the gunships were still flying. Yeah, doing a direct, direct support of the Grunts. So we were always out there, and we would have a LST over in the Mekong Delta River, and we'd be flying in there, maybe only 15 or 20 minutes away, load up with fuel and rockets, and fly back out.
So if you know the answer to this question, hearing all this and seeing and listening to how bad this was, is there a reason they didn't just attach medevac helicopters to these missions?
They didn't have enough of them, and the medevac guys had big red
they're targets
on the
right,
side,
right?
And they were getting their asses shot off because this is still we're still having a shootout out there.
True,
you know, somebody said, "Well, how many days of combat did you have in Vietnam?" I said, every day that I flew, I was getting shot at. I have 47 air medals, to give you an idea. Okay, wow. So back to the LSTs. We'd go out there, and one day we went out there, and CNC said, stay there for just a few minutes, and I've got they had F-4s coming in, fast movers. I got fast movers coming in, so just stay out of the zone here for a few minutes. So I was there on the LST, and we had two helicopters parked there. And the chief bosun's mate, I don't know what rank he was, he's an old guy with a cigar, and he bossed everybody around like this, you know. Anyway, he came out with two ice cold cokes, one for me, one for the co-pilot. Another one of these guys gave the crew chief and gunner a coke, and did the same thing for the helicopter. And we thought, you know, we love the Navy. We love the Navy. And we did. We did love the Navy because they supported everything that we were doing. So then he says, hey, if you don't have to go back into the shootout, would you just fly by the fantail and fire a couple of rockets into the tree line and maybe shoot some minigun? a bunch of our guys just got cameras at the BX, and they want to get a picture of you guys flying by really low and fast and shooting. And I said, sure. So the CNC called and said, hey, everything's over with out here. You guys can return to base. I said, okay. So we take off. I circle around, and I fly by the ass end of this LST, and I'm shooting rockets. And the whole tree line erupted and returned fire. There was a whole unit over there. Yeah. So anyway, it was a shock to me to have all those traces zooming by me when I was just doing a firepower demonstration.
These are some good cameras.
I talked to that chief later, and he said that was just a little bit too realistic, Ken. Yeah. So
now you had a gunship. Your Huey, the C model, the slick, I guess you called it.
The Charlie model was a gunship. It didn't have the gunner's well on the side. It's a little bit shorter.
Okay.
But it looked quite similar. The Seawolves were the Navy gunships. They had basically the same ship. They were Bravo models. And we had on wings little pylons, 2.75-inch folding fin aerial rockets, which I had 19 on each pod. And those were 17-pound warheads, so that's like shooting a 105 howitzer at somebody.
Wow.
And then right next to it was a minigun, and we had about 6,500 rounds for both miniguns. And since they shot 3,000 rounds a minute, you didn't have a lot of shooting. Basically, the helicopter, we're grossed out every time we took off, and in that hot country, the helicopter didn't want to fly. Matter of fact, my aircraft commander was still is my good friend. He told me the first day we flew, he said, hey, if you can hover this thing out to the runway, you can fly all day. I said, shit, I can do that. I just went through flight school. I know how to do that. I could not bring that helicopter to hover to save my ass.
Really?
It was just not, cushion, the ground cushion that you build up, you have to maintain a very steady control of the rotor blades, or else if you tilt the rotor blades slightly, your air spills out and takes more power. You don't have more power. So I couldn't hover. And I have been in situation, and people think I'm lying about this, but it's not. It's true. We had the door gunner and crew chief walk out to the runway with us, still hooked up with their helmets, and we'd start moving. They'd be running alongside of us and jump in at the last minute. Honest to God.
Because that's how you had to take off.
Yeah, and we were downsizing on the fuel. We'd only put about 1,000 pounds of fuel on, and it held about 1,400. So, we were downsizing on the fuel. So, but still, hot and heavy. And every time I get I go through the helicopter, throw a bunch of stuff out, and then the crews would start adding more smoke grenades, more grenades, more ammo. You know, pretty soon, the helicopter's back up over gross weight. So
when you say, because I just wanted to clarify then, because I think most people, when they picture a Huey in Vietnam, they would picture the shooting being done by, a door gunner with a 60. You're talking about the pilot controlling, similar to a fighter aircraft or a ground, air-to-ground aircraft, where you have a weapon system controlled by the pilot. You can target, you can fire, you can do all that yourself.
Right. The rocket had a rocket sight in front of me. The aircraft commander flew off the right side in the Charlie model. The co-pilot, or Peter pilot, we called him, flew off the left side. He had the minigun sight that came down in front of him, and that was slaved via hydraulics to the minigun, so you could elevate and traverse the miniguns. So he controlled that. If he wasn't controlling it, they fired straight ahead, so I could fire the miniguns and the rocket. Now, we had a crew chief and door gunner, possibly the most best people, the most important people on the whole crew were sitting back there, and they had M60s that were highly modified. M60s. Anybody know about M60s? They know they shoot about 550 rounds per minute. Our shot about 850 to 900 rounds a minute, because our crew chiefs were smart, and they would modify them with new different springs and highly modified. However, that meant that gun would, the receiver would crack out in about maybe 2 or 3 weeks. So we were going through them right and left. Those were made by the General Motors, by the way. So we'd get new ones and I'd go, what's wrong with this? And we'd put all the other original OEM parts back in it, turn it in. And they sent down this colonel to jack us up because we're going through so many M60 machine guns, cracked out receivers. And he wanted to ride with us in the helicopter and go, hey, wait a minute, colonel. He's an ordnance. I don't remember what the officer insignia was, like cross flaming bombs or something like that. Anyway, he was a light colonel, and he went out to fly with us. He flew about 30 minutes with us and asked if we'd let him off. We said, well, we're going to let you off. He said, I don't give a shit where you let me off. Just let me out of this helicopter. So there was a local Vietnamese base there. We dropped him off at this base. I to this day, I have no idea whatever happened to him after that, you know. But anyway, they started rewelding the M60s and send us rewelds in. And I don't think the ordnance people to this day knew that we were modifying that machine gun so it fired much faster. And the door gunner and crew chief each sat on a box of minigun ammo that they put laid in there. It was about 1,500 rounds. And they put an armor-plated seat on it. They wore a chicken plate front and back. And their gun was suspended on a bungee cord. There was no mount on it, like on the slits.
Okay, so I have seen pictures of M60s mounted on a bungee, and I have always wondered, and I just never took the time to research it, but I had seen those pictures, and I went, I wonder why some of them were cable mounted and some of them were, you know, hard mounted. And so you're saying that your aircraft specifically was the kind that had the 60 guns via, you know, on a cable as opposed to on a pedestal mount.
Right. Not only were they on bungee cords, the sights had been taken off, the bipod, and they didn't have the butterfly triggers. They had a single pistol grip on it, and they'd been stripped down. They kept a couple of barrels there and a heavy mitten to change out barrels. And, they would change barrels out like a couple times a day. The typical day, the gunner and crew chief would shoot 2,000 to 3,000 rounds each.
Wow.
Not counting the miniguns. And as a result of them being, we call those free guns because they were free to move in any. You could put a round through the rotor blades, which never happened to me, but I've heard of it happen. It's not catastrophic, but it pisses maintenance off to no end. You could shoot back under the helicopter, which comes in handy because the VC and the NVA like to shoot at us if we turned away from the target. If our wingman wasn't right there to cover our ass, or we broke off early from the target, they'd light us up the minute we turned away from the target. But where the door gunner would lean out and shoot back under the tail boom and keep their heads down.
That's
and they were quite good at it. Now, I am still, to this day, I did 50 years of flying Hueys, by the way, after Vietnam. I'm dyslexic. I don't know my left from my right. That can be a real problem when you're a helicopter pilot.
I was going to say.
That shows you the low standard they had when I went through flight school. So anyway, oftentimes the crew would see something that was dangerous, like a crew-served weapon or something. And they'd yell out in the intercom, break right or break left. Well, you can imagine with a dyslexic pilot.
Like, oh, it's 50-50.
That could lead to. So I would break sometimes right, sometimes left. Who knows? Nobody knew. I didn't even know. But it would screw up. The guys in back would be braced for, say, a hard break right. And all of a sudden, they're falling on their ass with a loaded machine gun in their hand. And I had one of my better crew chiefs, who's still a really good friend of mine. I won't say his name. He put two rounds in the back of my seat. Fortunately, armor plated seat, no problem. You know, got my attention. The crew chiefs and gunners got most of the kills. On a typical day, we'd kill 30 to 40 enemy. We call them gooks in those days. I know that's not politically correct, but that's what we call them. We'd kill 30 to 40, and there's probably half of those or more than half were killed by the door gunner. They were very good. We had a papasan one day out in the middle of a rice field plowing with a water buffalo, and he had two, we thought, NVA soldiers right next to him. They dropped their rifles. They were still in uniform, and they were standing shoulder to shoulder with this papasan. He was waving his papers at us. Now, we're like 50 feet away from these people. This is not Air Force ship or even Navy ship. This is down in the mud where I was getting mud on the front of my windshield and sometimes blood on the front of my windshield. Anyway, I asked the door gunner, I said, hey, those are two bad guys there. I said, can you shoot those without shooting Papasan? And I just got Papasan out of my mouth and there was just two short pop, pop. And those two guys just folded up, fell face first into the mud, didn't even move. And he looked up at us and just shrugged his shoulders at us like, well, I tried. And then kept on plowing. Wow. So anyway, I can't say enough about our door gunners and crew chiefs. They were very good. Also, you know, you hear shit about bad commanders in Vietnam. And I guess they had them. And I've heard stories. But we had Hackworth. We had a battalion commander. It was every bit as good as him. My company commander was on it. And my company commander and battalion commander were out there in the field with us flying. So they were getting their asses shot off too. So we'd have a provincial representative, what do they call him? He's like a village chief. He was not an army guy, but he was like a board of supervisors.
Like a councilman liaison.
Yeah. And he'd be in the helicopter, and he's a guy that said, die or not. And these were Vietnamese, by the way. They were wanting us to kill everybody. And we would say, now, wait a minute. We're not shooting a guy plowing with the water buffalo. Because we were right there, we could see the look on their face. I got to tell you, my year in Vietnam, I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed it. It was the greatest thing you could do. When somebody tried to shoot your ass, and they miss and you don't. That's right. A really a good feeling. Now, if I'd have got shot up and was missing an arm or leg, whole different ball game. But I worked with the 9th Division. They were called the Old Reliables for a good reason. I just thoroughly enjoyed them and was very lucky. I didn't have anybody in my platoon killed. After I left, 71 and 72 was the most the worst. Years for a pilot to be killed was in 71, 72. And that's because of the invasion of Laos. They lost a lot of pilots and a lot of helicopters up there. I did get shot. What's that?
Oh, that's what I was about to ask. Well, I mean, you, this question might have led into what you're probably about to say. I was going to ask, with the amount of firefights that you saw, like, you know, how much damage could these helicopters take?
Okay, they couldn't quite hear you.
How much, with the amount of firefighting you saw, how much damage could those helicopters take?
Not a lot, but you'd be surprised. Rounds were coming through them, and they just sort of snick, go through them. Then you'd hear them, bang. That's when they'd hit a part of the frame or the transmission or something. I had like 27. A guy right in front of me stood up and hosed us down with a full run magazine of AK ammo, and we just flew right on by him, circled back around and killed him with the door guns. So they would take more, you know, it's not like you're going to go down. And when you did get shot down, fortunately, it wasn't a ball of fire and you disappear over a hill and you see a mushroom cloud like in the movies. What happened would you'd be fluttered down like a wing shot dove. And I was laying, the helicopter was laying out in the middle of a rice paddy one day. And not laying, it was on the skids, and it was still running, but we'd had the controls of hydraulic shot out in that particular model.
Oh, I missed the part where you got shot. I mean, obviously you're telling the story. I missed the part where you said you got shot down.
Yeah, the helicopter, you said you set the helicopter down. It didn't, you know, crash. It just fluttered down.
Yeah, it just fluttered down because our hydraulics were shot out, and we're one of the problems with the Charlie Model Huey is that they don't fly, period, without hydraulics. And we're laying, I jump out of the helicopter with my little XM-174 that a dog handler had given me when I medevaced him and his dog out of the 9th Division one day. He gave me his rifle and his little short 8, little short M16. And I'm laying there, and the Viet Cong came running out across the rice paddy at about 300 yards to get the bounty that they had on us. And I shot three of them, and then the other two ran away. And meantime, the aircraft commander. I was still a Peter pilot. I think I was still a first lieutenant when all that, but I got a Bronze Star for that, by the way. I was Peter pilot, the commanding, the aircraft commander said, I think we should fly it back at just at low level. So if it quits, if we can't lower the collective, the part that goes up and down, we won't have to fall too far. Fine with me. So we loaded up the helicopter and we took off and we're hovering at about maybe 20 or 30 miles an hour. We hover to a Vietnamese triangular fort, mud fort, and we try and land, but guess what? No collective. So we just roll the throttle off. We're low enough that we take manual control of the throttle, roll the throttle off slowly. So we just settled right down on the dirt road there. It was great. I loved it. And I was so thankful to have got out of that rice paddy.
I could imagine.
I was hiding behind the dike and they were shooting and skipping rounds off over our head.
Was she mad? Was she mad that you were hiding behind her?
Yeah. And as I was laying there hiding down behind this dike, a dirt dike, a turd, a nice big long, finely tapered turd, came floating by right in front of me. I realized, I'd heard about them using human waste for rice fertilizer, and it was pretty obvious to me I was laying in a lot of crap, and literally. So I was happy to get out of there.
So, and this is, I don't know if a lot of people understand this, but the helicopter is a, second half of the 20th century kind of invention in military. You think about, World War One, World War Two, it was all airplanes, bombings, paratroopers and all that kind of stuff. But the helicopter didn't start really coming into its own until probably Korea, Vietnam, right? So you guys were really writing the book on rotary wing air assault tactics every day that you went out, right?
Correct. The first CAV showed up in Vietnam in about 65, and the Jarheads had helicopters over there even before that. They had Sikorsky 34s, and then they had the tandem rotor frogs, they called them. I don't know what they had up there, Doc, when you was up there, but they probably had both. And the Huey came along and changed everything because it had a lot of power to weight ratio. No matter what people say, it could take quite a bit of battle damage and keep on flying, at least get you back out of the line of fire. And the tactics, we had different kinds of assaults. We had full on combat assault. We'd put in a battalion, a company, or maybe even a battalion, land them behind the enemy, and then try and maybe land another company over here for a blocking force. So we're doing that quite a bit. They were doing the same thing up north, but down in the Delta, it was pretty open. The highest point where I flew was up on the Cambodian border called the Seven Sisters, and everything else was rice paddy land, nice and flat, with a big river that was like a half mile across it or more. I didn't fly the gunship all the time because every now and then they'd say, take a day off, because we're flying 180 hours a month. And anybody that knows about flying helicopters know you're not supposed to fly more than about 120, 140 hours. We'd be up to about 180, and the battalion flight surgeon would tell us to take time off. Well, time off was meant that we didn't fly combat assaults. We did ash and crash. So now we're flying in supplies or whatever. We're still flying, but we're not being hopefully shot at as much. So,
that's your day off. You're still flying. You're just not getting off, shot at as much.
I had two R&Rs while I was in Vietnam, two different R&Rs, and that takes about seven or eight days by the time you fly. I was flying to Hawaii to meet my wife, and I flew with two R&Rs. I flew 1,140 combat hours while I was in Vietnam in 1 year. So I, and I was a captain by the time I left, and about in December. I've been over there about nine or 10 months. Division commander said he needed a pilot. Or actually, he was a corps commander, and his pilot had rotated home. And they said, well, we got this guy. He's really, really good. And he got highest grades in flight school. We got this guy that just did a check ride. He's really good. And we got this other guy. He's not that good, but he's really lucky. And his credit, General Cantley said, hey, I'll take that lucky guy. So I became the general's pilot just because I was lucky and didn't kill him. I stayed in contact. He's now deceased, but he's a good friend of mine. He'd sit back there and sleep while I was flying him around.
So you're the embodiment of it's better to be lucky than good.
Exactly. And then even after Vietnam, I was very fortunate flying firefighting with helicopters and all kinds of stuff over the next, I have about 15,000 hours in Hueys.
Now, Mark, as a doc, Mark, were you working with both Marine pilots, Navy, and Army pilots, or was it a lot of Army pilots, or?
Well, go ahead, Mark.
From what I recall, it was most Marine pilots. We would see the Army choppers, but I don't recall having medevac or, and there may have been gunships from the Army, but I would swear to it. I don't know.
Well, Doc, my flight school class was half jarheads.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So when I went to flight school, all these guys show up and they got leather jackets on. Army guys got cheap ass nylon flight jackets. So I go, what is this? And they go, well, it's the Marine Corps sending their guys through Army flight school. And they were great to work with. They were awesome. And well, I could never talk any of them out of their leather jacket, by the way. But they were mostly up north. And down south, we did have Navy pilots flying they were the Sea Wolves flying the B-model gunships in the Delta. And that was a whole different war, that Delta, compared to up on the DMZ and everything. It was very interesting. They had a prison camp about 80 miles offshore called Fuqua. And one day, my company commander said, hey, you got to go to Fuqua Island, take another ship with you. We normally flew at least two ships, sometimes three. We call it the lead and then your wingman and a gunship. When we fly next to the slicks, we always had at least two, maybe three, sometimes even four, depending on how hairy it was. But anyway, that was called a fire team. Two ships was a fire team. A heavy fire team was three ships. Anyway, I go, where's that at? And he says, it's right here on the map. And keep in mind, this is before, one, you got a dyslexic pilot, and this is before a GPS, and we didn't have much for navigation. And plus, I was afraid of the water, basically. I almost drowned when I was a child, but that's another story. So I didn't really like the water that much. And we're flying out along there, and I go, oh, shit, we're getting low on fuel, and I don't see no Fuqua Island. So there's a little tiny island, about maybe an acre or two, and there was a boat tied up, and I landed right on the beach because that was the only place to land. I told the co-pilot, I said, look, you got to hold some power in this thing because we're going to sink in the sand, so don't get it sink. So I got out, and there's old, wheezing, brown, leathery old guy, probably 40 or 50 years old with a goatee, and he was a fisherman. I said, I'm trying to find Fuqua Island, and he pointed for me and said, Fuqua Island, and pointed. I thought, oh, shit. This guy's telling, I hope he's not a VC or something, telling me to go the wrong way. And I went the way he pointed, and just within about another 20 miles, we could see it on the horizon, and we went out there. And they'd had the prisoners had taken over, and there was 20,000 prisoners there. They'd taken over from the guards and were basically running things. And the light colonel that was the advisor there said, hey, did you bring flechette rockets? And I said, yeah, I did. He goes, well, I want you to go in there and kill as many of these shitheads as you can. And I go, what? He goes, yeah. He says, they're all rioting. and you need to just kill them. I go, I'm thinking, you know, I remember that class I had in OCS about worlds of warfare and Geneva Convention, all that shit. Wasn't quite tracking for me, you know? So, Doc, I don't know if they had these where you're at, but the Vietnamese love to herd ducks. They would have big, big, gigantic flocks of ducks, of thousands of ducks, big, white, fluffy ducks. And they had a big herd of them there on the island, and they were right up next to the wire. And I said, I'll tell you what we'll do. I said, we'll do a firepower demonstration first. So I get back out there at about 500 feet at about a 45, and I punch off two Flechette rockets, and they go off just perfectly. And just kill the shit out of the ducks, white feathers flying, everything. And all the prisoners go, okay, we give up. We're at it. We're back in ourselves, you know.
So, yeah.
Anyway, I didn't have to kill anybody. But anyway, you know, a lot of times we were on our own out there. I would be like the captain in charge of everything, which is a scary thought in itself. But we would take some pretty heavy fire up around Cambodia. And if you remember on your history, we had an invasion of Cambodia in June, I believe it was, of 70. Well, before that, in that winter before that, they chewed at us with radar control guns, 37 millimeters. You'd hear it buzz on your FM radio and you know, oh shit, I'm being tracked by radar. And so we change course, and they shoot off airburst, you know, which is very scary for helicopter pilots. Are you familiar with a piconometer on a helicopter?
No.
A piconometer? Okay, it's a device that tells you what your pucker factor is. And every time you get an airburst, my pucker factor would go all the way over into the red. I mean, maxed out. So one day, the special forces guy that was there on the ground, we're always taking him. He said, you know what? If you would go way up into Cambodia and then come down southbound, they would never know where you were coming from or, you know, where you were at. He says, if you try and fly straight across the border here, they'll shoot your ass down with one of those radar controlled guns. I said, yeah, but isn't that, are we supposed to be up there? He said, yeah, I've given you permission to go up there. And I go, okay, he's like a major who like can give me permission to invade another country. So I said, it sounds good to me. He says, but you got to stay here. I have some food brought out to you guys. You got to stay here and just tell. I told CNC was just not too far away. But CNC, we got a chip light. Want to check it out as soon as we are finished with the chip light. There's a thing you got to check to make sure transmission wasn't going to seize up. We'll be back to Dong Tam as soon as we check it out. And fine. He takes off for Dong Tam. We wait about 30 minutes to where they're having reveille formation over on the other side. Think about that. We fly like we're going to Dong Tam, circle way around like 20 miles, and then come in. And I tell my wingman, I said, come up next to me. And we were dumping everything we got, one pass, like one ping and one ping only. We're dumping everything. We're dumping everything we got. And we did. And oh, it was it was unbelievable. None of the stuff you saw in, what was that war movie, where they, I love the smell of napalm morning.
Apocalypse Now.
Yeah, that was not even close to what happened that day. So we flew right on by and we fly into Dong Tam. Well, what time we get into Dong Tam, guess what? The battalion commanders out there, some civilians that were probably the Christians in action. I'm not sure who they were. You know who the Christians in actions are, right?
The missionaries, right?
CIA. Christians in action. Oh. So,
wait, is that what you called them?
Yeah, it's what we call them.
Wow.
So anyway, okay. They were waiting for us, and when we shut down the helicopter, they were on us like stink on doo-doo. And they wouldn't know about it. I thought about lying at that point. Colonel McGrill was the battalion commander. He ended up being a general also. He was a real ass kicker. He said, well, you tell me what happened, Captain Carlton. I said, well, Major so-and-so gave me permission to go to Cambodia. He goes, oh, you got to be shitting me. That's what you're basing your whole career on, the fact that you could be in Long Bend Junction, which was a jail in Vietnam. You could be in Long Bend Junction for the rest of your natural life. I go, yeah. So he says, well, it's good that you didn't lie to me, because we know what happened. He says, don't do that again. He says, if you do it again, you're going to be in really trouble because we're trying to get lined up to do an invasion up there. And if you keep killing them like that, we won't have to do the invasion. It's going to be a lot of fun.
That sounds like a real life version of Flight of the Intruder.
Exactly. Exactly. Don't do it again.
Don't do it. Yeah. Oh, you completely bombed and invaded a place where we had specific orders not to.
And there was hundreds of casualties. Hundreds of casualties. Wow. My company commander is walking back with me, and I think it was Major. I had several of them while I was over there. I can't remember which one it was, but he's a West Pointer, and he's walking back with me, and he goes, "Ken, I'd rather be lucky than good, and you were just lucky today that this all lined up for you, because otherwise," he says, "you were going to go to prison."
Wow. So, well, and then you after you left the military, you flew in the fire service. And
no, I started out being a cop, flying cop, and I did that until I retired for 29 years, and then I retired at age 52, and I needed something to do, and that's when I went into fighting fire.
Because I knew you did both, and I just didn't know in what order. But you've been flying a helicopter in public service, saving people or putting people down one way or the other for 50 years.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what. Coming home from Vietnam is damn boring, okay? After flying gunships in Vietnam, it was damn boring. Doc's laughing and shaking his head. He knows exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But flying fires and dropping water right next to guys on the ground, they're about to get their little asses burned off. It's really a good feeling. And they love it when they got a Vietnam helicopter pilot overhead and a Huey. It's a twin-engine Huey, like what the Navy had. They were called N model. Anyway, a twin-engine Huey overhead with 385 gallons of water will save their ass more than once. It was great. I loved it.
Well, we appreciate you coming on, Ken. We'd like to have you both back. You both have great stories and probably tons more.
Hey, wait. Are we out of time?
We are actually out of time. It's amazing how fast that goes.
I figured I'd been talking about 15 minutes. Okay.
Yeah, it's...
We have fed him hardly any shit, did we?
Yeah. I was expecting a lot more of a shit sandwich than this. So if you guys don't mind, we can have you back together or separate, doesn't matter. But, you know, a lot of people, for example, Mark and I met through Aaron at Dawn's. I think I had met you when I was a teenager, but not really remembering it because I was at the family functions or whatever. But we met in earnest at Don Bilski's funeral services, and we had talked about this show, and then Ken, I know your daughter because she's in law enforcement as well, and she had talked to me about you, and so I kind of met you both through friends of mine, and I thought John and I had talked about seeing if we could get people who had served in Vietnam to come on the show, and hopefully if we've got listeners out there that have family members or have in fact served in Vietnam themselves, they're willing to come on and share their stories with us as well, because we understand, just like anything, sometimes everybody's Vietnam experience. I mean, if you listen to our previous episode with Mark and you listen to our this episode with Ken, everybody's experience was so different, right? Everybody saw a different Vietnam, and sometimes you saw a different Vietnam, you know, during the same tour. You were changed from point A to point B, and your experience completely changes. So we understand that, and it's nice to have you two on to kind of give the balance to that story. We'd love to have you guys back. Ken, we always try to dedicate an episode to one of our brothers and sisters in law enforcement, fire service, military that has passed on before us and paid the ultimate price, made the ultimate sacrifice. We usually give our guests the opportunity to pick someone. So do you have somebody in mind that you would like to dedicate this episode to?
Well, I still have two people. One is one of my crew chiefs by the name of Bill Flores that put up with my shit of turning the wrong way more than once when I was supposed to be breaking right and I broke left. And the other one was the aircraft commander that taught me basically how to fly in Vietnam, David Hamilton. Both of them are still close friends of mine, and I stay in touch with them. Thank you guys both.
Well, you know what? That's good. Dedicating episodes to people that saved your ass instead of losing theirs is good, too. So we appreciate that. Mark, do you have any final thoughts, final words before we close out here?
Not really, but I would enjoy doing this again. like I said earlier, there are more things to talk about, and I think Ken would probably agree with that. And if we do set something up, there are one or two people that I may suggest to participate. One of them was my gunny sergeant, Walt Sides, who coincidentally was the one that began founding father of Rolling Thunder in Washington, D.C. I don't know, Ken.
All right.
That's... But he was the founding father of that. And he was the one that hauled my ass up to the chopper when I got hit. So, yeah.
That'd be a good one. Well, and I know, you know, from both of you, from talking to you beforehand, there's always trepidation. You know, I've never done this before. I'm sharing very personal stuff. And some people are anxious in a way of like, ah, I can't wait to do it. And some people are anxious in the way of, you know, I'm not sure how this is going to go. I hope it's been a good experience for both of you. I hope we've made you feel comfortable, and I hope that our listeners who've been there and done that, or who maybe haven't been there and done that and don't understand, get something out of this. John, do you want to?
No, thank you guys so much for being on here. Respect you guys truly, seriously.
Yeah. You, for anybody of our listeners, please, you know, if you haven't liked and subscribed and reviewed and done all that, please do. And follow us on all the social media platforms. We have some new ideas about merch. Mm-hmm. So watch for our social media. John and I just discussed one, and we'll give a little tease. I think we're going to do Ranger panties. We're going to do OD green Ranger panties with our logo on them. So,
summer apparel line.
Yeah, it's our summer. Now that summer's over, you know, it's funny. We do sweatshirts, pre-order them, and then they finally ship in the summertime when people can't wear them. We're going to do the Ranger panties now, and then people can't wear those in the winter.
Whatever.
Whatever. We're behind the eight ball on the merch this year. We appreciate you both coming on. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, rate, review, like, subscribe. Give us your feedback if you enjoyed the episode. If there's questions you have for either these two gentlemen or for us, send us a message. We try to read the emails when we get them, or we answer them privately if you ask us to do that. Yep. But until our next episode, as we always say, come home with your shield or on it.